listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast which spends an inordinate amount of time thinking and talking about the invasion of the hot Italians. Or is that just me? I'm Nathan.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Todd.
I'm Peter.
Well, it's episode 12, and you know what that means. Any number of celebrity guest cameos swiftly followed by the imminent destruction of the entire universe. But since it looks like we're planning to actually follow through this year, we must have only about an hour left to discuss what happens when the Pandorica opens. This is an episode 12, and over the past sort of 4 years or so, not counting the specials, we've been trained to expect certain things from episode 12. Does this do them, do we think?
We have 7 minutes of pre-credit sequence. Have we had that before?
No, that is a special thing, isn't it?
I adore it, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I remember this was the first full season I saw when I was living in the UK, and I remember sitting in my house in London with my flatmate, who is also a big Doctor Who fan. Hello, Lee Thompson. And just our jaws getting progressively lower with, oh my God, it's Liz Ted. Oh my God, it's River Song. Oh my God, it's Winston Churchill. Oh my God, it's Vincent. And I think I just did them in reverse order. But yeah, it was gobsmacking. After about the second one, you're thinking they're going, oh my God, are they going to do everyone?
It's the first time that Stephen Moffat does that kind of cutting between vignettes breathlessly in a teaser. And Russell did it in 2008 with The Stolen Earth, and it worked so well. I was a little bit disappointed that we didn't get more. I mean, where was Cully from The 11th Hour or Air Kiss Guy from Football Guy from The Lodger? You know, I wanted them all back, but it was amazing.
It is different, though, isn't it, from that Stolen Earth thing? Because the Stolen Earth is set in a universe that's been carefully built up over 4 years, and the RTD finales generally tend to put us back in that world. So they're always at least partly set on Earth in the present day in this sort of well-known world. But Moffat doesn't create a universe for the Doctor to have his adventures in. Moffat is telling a series of Doctor Who stories, and so what we get instead is little bits of the previous stories that we've had this year. And I think they're marvellous, and I think that what he does is this caper. It's like it's a caper about a painting, a Van Gogh painting, a lost Van Gogh painting, and you know, we're tracing it. We don't see the painting until the very, very, very last moment. We hear about the painting. We trace River Song's adventures, all of that sort of stuff, and it's so light and fun and funny despite the clear stakes, which are made absolutely clear at the end.
It is very funny. I mean, it gets, you know, the big blue guy.
Yeah.
Dorian turning up, that whole sequence with, you know, the vortex manipulator off the wrist of a handsome time agent.
Which is Captain Jack, right?
He grew one back.
Also, it's a nod back to like the Doctor getting his hand chopped off as well. I didn't think about that as well. But, and then the whole, what does she put in his drink, Nathan?
Oh, micro explosives. And he takes a quick sip and then asks what micro explosives. It's so,
and that's
perfect.
Totally River stealing that from Princess Leia in Return of the Jedi. Oh, he's holding a thermal detonator. And let's face it, Dorian's not unlike Jabba the Hutt.
My favorite bit is the pretty young guard who she sort of Mrs. Robinson's and seduces. And that limp, you know, a sort of stick figure that he then thinks is her with the sort of big hair. It's just, it's so fun. It's so incredibly fun.
Yeah, and then of course to cut to Amy and the Doctor, like, you know, 4 minutes into that teaser, and you know, the Hollow Sweetie, the first recorded words in history. I mean, really, and then the Roman Legion, and you know, what is he? He's mistaken for what? Caesar? Or?
Yeah. Because of her lipstick.
She's Cleopatra. I mean, it's just
such a romp. It's absolutely wonderful.
It's light and fun, and it's clearly going places.
Yeah. Notice how River has escalated her "Hello, sweetie" every time she's appeared. So the first time it was on the psychic paper. The second time it's sort of carved into the black box of the Byzantium. And then, you know, the third time it's now carved on a giant cliff. And the two, it says "Hello, sweetie" there at the top. And then there's Theta Sigma are the first two characters in the second row. And then there's some coordinates or whatever the hell it is. But it's just so fun. And I think that computer-generated planet looks awesome.
It is the first time they've there's a planet, isn't there, in Army of Ghosts where they visit just in the teaser for, like, you know, Rose says, "I never want to leave the Doctor." And it's similarly spectacular because they only have to do it for the one shot.
Yeah.
But even then, you know, that is like a rocky planet, so they can get David and Billy to stand on that rocky beach that becomes Bad Wolf Bay as well, and dinosaurs on a spaceship and just CGI in some rocks. But this is lush, hopefully not aggressive vegetation.
It reminds me of really Mechanus. It's absolutely.
Well, what doesn't?
But it's absolutely a sort of Terry Nation style Dalek jungle planet with giant fungoids and stuff.
He missed a beat there. You know, when River is saying, like, who else is coming, and she does her megalist, she should have said the mechanoids.
Well, go ahead and say, I would have loved the Hartnell version of that. Can you imagine how that would have gone? Dalek, Sensorites, Dravens, Monoids, Malpha, Maya B. East Dodo.
Immediately after the opening credits, we head straight into something that is shot as a heist, isn't it? We see them planning to go to Stonehenge, you know, pulling out the maps, intercut with them on the horses heading there.
Well, and they're doubles.
Yeah. And again, it's just fun. Caper, heist, you know, the whole thing is such an incredible adventure. Like, we very, very quickly are in sort of Indiana Jones mode.
Absolutely. It totally reminded me of, you know, the music. Murray picks up on it. The music is very Indiana Jones. But it explicitly casts River in the Indiana Jones role. And I think it makes the Doctor sort of maybe a cross between Marcus, Denham Elliott's character, and maybe Henry,
yeah,
his dad. I mean, it's the most Indiana Jones the Doctor Who's ever been, and it's just brisk and wonderful.
I enjoy it so much. Like, you know, the stone moving away, the nicely placed torches and the big door, and yeah, exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
I just get into this, and it looks sensational.
That underhenge is wonderful. I mean, aren't we grateful we didn't pay one last visit to the paper mill?
It is a thing that we've done before where, you know, there's a secret base or something hidden underneath a famous landmark. Mm. I mean, it's an RTD era thing, but here it's done so well.
And much like back in the Shakespeare Code, Doctor Who was the first drama given permission to film at Stonehenge.
Oh, wow.
And they got one night. So the riding up on the horses was done just after sunset, to indicate dawn, in fact. So the idea is when they're then getting underneath at night, in story terms, they have been there the whole day setting this up and trying to find whatever. And the stone that Matt Smith jumps onto, it's a prop stone. It's not one of the real ones. But even then, they had to get permission to put a prop stone in for him to jump onto. And it was just apparently this really complex thing. And Toby Haynes, the director, basically says all the way through, I was expecting some hand to come down on my shoulder and say, right, you've had your time. So we just got as much done as humanly possible. It was bucketing down. So we only got about half as much done as we wanted, and we were still grateful of it because they had always intended to get as much done there as possible and then build a replica, which they called Foamhenge.
I think I saw that in the Stones of Blood.
But they made contingencies for shooting at other stone circles and writing dialogue as to why it's the Rollright Stones, for instance, rather than Stonehenge. But both Toby Haynes and Stephen Moffat were like, if we can't get Stonehenge, what's the point?
The cachet of this show.
Yeah, yeah. It's huge, isn't it? And then we get the Pandorica, and I think the Pandorica is absolutely classic Stephen Moffat, which is kind of a mystery whose answer is hidden in plain sight.
I agree. He does it all the time. He does these little lines of dialogue where he misdirects your thinking, and it's between River and the Doctor where I don't think they say it directly, but it's intimated that there's something inside.
Yeah.
So you keep thinking that there's something inside.
Yeah.
Rather than what actually happens is somebody's going to be put in there, and it's very clever.
And there's another misdirection, isn't there? Because we talk about who's in the box, and as you said, Todd, we're assuming that it's occupied, and River has that dialogue about how it's being opened from inside. And it's that speech, that incredibly beautiful speech that Matt gives about a goblin or a trickster who will fall out of the sky and tear down your world. And who locked him in the box? A good wizard did it, the Doctor says. And then River gets the dialogue, you know, I hate good wizards in fairy tales. They always end up being him. And so for a second, we get the idea that he's the one who has or will have locked whatever it is in the box.
It's Stephen explicitly spelling out what you've been saying all season, Nathan, is that he's interested in stories and everything about Doctor Who is a story. And because this is the whole thing is a trap, which is conjured out of Amy's childhood and Amy's favorite books and things like that. And she created the Raggedy Man stories. And as we'll see next week, she's going to recreate the Raggedy Man.
Yeah,
so it's all about stories becoming manifest.
Yeah.
It's interesting you say that because like here he introduces that Romans are Amy's favourite topic in history and Pandora's box is her favourite fairy tale. I don't know whether that's been mentioned before. Next year it's going to annoy me when he does introduce certain things like, you know, people that they've known their lifetime, right?
Yeah.
But here it works so wonderfully well.
Yeah, I agree. And so we get shots of the Doctor saying, who are you? Who could you possibly be?
Which he says several times.
Yeah, and he's in shot. And there is that thing, if it's something this big, I would know about it. And, you know, I don't know what you think about the Doctor being so famous. You know, in this era, in this part of the Moffat era, the Doctor's terribly famous. Everyone knows who he is. And we've been watching the Doctor for a long time, and we feel like we've got a handle on the universe that he lives in, the Doctor Who stories. And so for us as well, who could it possibly be in the box? Surely we would know. If it's this big, is it Fenric? Is it the Black Guardian? You know, it's got to be something that we already know about because the Doctor Who universe has been filled up over, you know, 50 years or whatever, nearly 50 years at this point.
It's Moffat playing with fan expectations, isn't it? But also, is he doing a wordplay? Who could you possibly be? Doctor Who could you possibly be?
It's also, you know, obviously Matt's in shot because he's delivering those lines, but the answer to the question is in shot as he asks it.
Can you remember when you were watching if and when you picked it was going to be for the Doctor? Or was it a shock when the box opens and there's nothing in there?
It was shock.
Yeah.
I was completely shocked.
Yeah.
Completely. Brendan? Yeah.
Well, my flatmate and I discussed it after that, and I said I thought it was going to be John Sim. I thought it was going to be the Master because we don't know what happened to him. Whereas Lee said, oh, no, I knew it was the Doctor, but I still got it wrong. He said, I thought it was going to be Sylvester McCoy because who is the Doctor who falls from the sky and tears down your world? It's Sylvester McCoy.
That would have been a dramatic highlighter.
Yeah. I mean, but it's all of them, though. You know, think about the pirate planet. Think about the savages. You know, the Doctor drops out of the sky and blows everything up in episode 4. before. It happens over and over again. And the Doctor has done this so much that that description of him from the villain's point of view actually really works. And that's what Moffat's all about, isn't he? Like, people having different points of view on things, people's knowledge being partial, people's memories being imperfect. All of that stuff is what he's about.
And it's a really interesting idea to look at it from the villain's point of view. You actually do side with them in sort of those last scenes coming out where you've got Christopher Ryan, who, by the way, I'm sad that we lost him as kind of our go-to Sontaran. Should have just been him. When he is like, you know, we've joined forces because the Doctor destroys our universe in many ways. And that's really fun to think about.
Yeah.
And the thing is, he... Commander Stark looks so proud when the Pandorica's closing at the end. And I'm kind of with you that we've gotten so used to Dan Starkey being the Sontaran. I just remember at the time thinking that, you know, obviously we hadn't seen the Sontaran since then, except for one cameo in Doctor Who, and of course in the Sarah Jane Avengers, where it's always Dan Starkey. So I was kind of the opinion that, oh, Christopher Ryan obviously didn't enjoy working on the show, but he comes back to do this. And I remember at the time going, sort of being almost pulled out of the scene going, that's Christopher Ryan.
He's got a very nice line in kind of nodding, going, as the Doctor is being put in Pandorica.
I approve of this.
That was very good, Brent.
Hey, I know for a fact that if I'm ever a Doctor Who monster, it's going to be a Sontaran. I've been practicing.
But Peter, you are totally right. It's a shame that he doesn't come back as a Sontaran later on. Like, he's actually really good. But I also like the fact that you've got the big Daypole Daleks back after them buggering off like earlier on in the season. You know, what have they been up to? And I do think it's a shame after this that they're just completely basically sidelined and written out. Like, I actually quite like the colours and the bigness and the sort of the 60s filmic nature of them. But I think it's really great that the Daleks and the Cybermen and the Sontarans. Who else gets to speak? Anybody else?
No, but basically every single kind of monster costume that they have lying around is there. And I have to confess that the scene doesn't make any sense. Like, if you're trying to kind of make it actually work, you know, if you're, you know, writing a history or editing some TARDIS Wikia pages or whatever, you're going to be hard-pressed to explain what's going on, because why are there Silurians there?
Exactly.
You know, how do Cybermen even get there? In RTD's era, RTD was very, very careful to give the Cybermen a coherent story and to explain how every appearance fit in with that story. And he had an eye to the sort of 10-year-old fan that he once was, who was going to kind of, you know, make up those stories, you know, the future David Banks, perhaps, who was going to kind of tell a coherent story about how the Cybermen came to be. And the Cybermen are created in 2006 by Roger Lloyd Pack, you know, like, like, it's a definite thing that happens. Why are they here in 102 AD? Like, it just doesn't make any sense at all. And when the Cyberman appears, he's literally nothing like any Cyberman that has ever been before.
I just want to say here, like, as you know, through this journey, I've reevaluated Russell Cyberman and I like them so much more. But at the time, I had not liked basically all the Cyberman appearances up to this point. And I just enjoyed having them being so creepy, that one lone Cyberman with its head chomping at Amy and being able to, you know, the dart going into her and then the horrible tentacle things as it's along the floor. I just thought, wow, this is scary. And and he's reinventing what they can do. And I really, really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it again.
Yeah.
He'll do the same with the Daleks in a season or so's time, doing a different take, and that's Stephen's thing. But I really like the fact for the first time I actually felt that the Cybermen were actually scary.
Yeah.
In modern Doctor Who.
So Moffat's Cybermen are dead bodies encased in armour.
Yes.
Aren't they?
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, we've had three showrunners for the new series now. And when you look at something like the Daleks, even though each of the showrunners does do something interesting with them, it all comes back to the same germ of an idea that, you know, the Dalek is a crazed creature in a tank.
Yeah.
Whereas I do feel that Russell and Stephen and Chris Chibnall have all come up with different takes on the Cybermen that you kind of go, that is something the other writer didn't do.
Yeah.
So I remember that scene you're talking about, Todd, with the snap, the head kind of biting at Amy, you know.
Which she plays so well.
Oh, like Karen. Yeah, that's the thing. Karen is fighting a helmet and she's amazing. But I remember at the end of that scene thinking, because Cybermen are my favorite monsters, I'm like, that is better than every single Cyberman scene we've had up till that point from Russell. And that's not an insult, but that is just, oh my God, that's amazing. And I got the same thing from Ashard. I loved the take on Ashard in series 12. So I kind of feel like maybe the showrunners are sort of, we can't change the Daleks too much. And like literally Moffat comes in and tries to change the Dalek design. And I'm with you, Todd. I quite like them, but there's a huge backlash against them. And he backpedals on that furiously and kind of semi explains it with a voiceover at the Doctor Who Experience.
Of course he does.
Of course he does. Whereas it's almost like the production teams can put a new spin on the Cybermen every time because people aren't invested in them. They're always looking at the Daleks. So you can do new stuff with the Cybermen. And I think it goes back to Eric Saward, who brings back the Cybermen in Earthshock and really interrogates, okay, now what makes them scary? And how can I make them as scary as they were in the 60s, but feel 1980s and feel very modern? And yeah, I think it's something you can do with the Cybermen. I imagine the temptation would have been, let's have a Dalek guarding the Underhenge, because if I'm sure Stephen Moffat's a fan like us and he'd be going, I need to have a monster guarding this, of course his first thought would be Dalek. But instead he goes, no, let's turn this into a horror movie. Let's have a slow moving monster like Jason Voorhees. That's the thing that people complain about as the Friday the 13th series goes on. Jason turns into this fast, unstoppable killer, whereas in the early films, he's slow and he is just one step at a time coming after you. And that's the thing, when Amy gets stunned by the head and says, you and whose body, we just hear clump, clump, clump.
But the fact too is like the Cyberman's already dismembered. Like who dismembered the Cyberman? And you kind of think, well, you know, it's just lying around. Nothing really is going to happen. But then bit by bit, it comes into play. Like even the cyber arm, like with that hilarious moment with Matt Smith, look at me, I'm a target. Or was that her? I can't remember.
No, that's him. And the line before that is something like where he says to Amy, you know how I come up with these brilliant plans. Well, sorry. And then he runs in and just says that and is so stupid and sort of wonderful.
I did that at the shops earlier. I ran down and said, look at me, I'm at Target. I have several thoughts about that. I think that the Cybermen have always been a slightly amorphous enemy, and so they've just fitted into whatever the plot needs them to do, which becomes strength under showrunners who want them to do different and interesting things. And I think it's nice that Stephen does that writerly trick of having so many monsters and aliens show up that they're just kind of a horde and we don't get much time with them. And so he chooses one example earlier in the episode to just do something interesting with a solitary member of that race. And also, don't you think that Karen with the snapping helmet does the best companion struggling with monster prop that is supposed to be attacking her but is actually just being held by her since Sarah in Revenge of the Cybermen?
Thanks for that, Brendan. If you heard that, everybody, he was getting attacked by a fake Cyberman.
I don't know what you're talking about. A cockatoo just flew in here.
My favourite thing that she does is when Matt encourages her to do what he's just done and run out and draw the arms fire, and he does the thumb up and she does this sort of terrified, I really, really don't want to do this thumbs up, which is so good.
That whole scene crystallizes their relationship for this season. And I have to say, I've had a bit of an epiphany on Karen. I always thought she was okay, but I didn't love her. I think she's just been great through this season. And the sense of fun that they have together and the business that they work out is just really joyous to watch on screen. And that moment where the Doctor says, stay back, and, you know, stay undercover. And she takes sort of three steps back with the most pouty reaction ever. It's hilarious.
Well, I mean, I'm with you, Peter, and call me a cliche, listeners. I have not liked her much in the past, but I think her performances this season, I can see so much more, and she's much, much better. Like the humor she really gets and the danger here, especially in this episode. So I've grown to really like her over the past few episodes. But even earlier on, I could see that all happening. So she's grown for me throughout the season, even if Amy at times is not my favorite person, but I think Karen's doing a wonderful, wonderful job.
Agreed.
So that scene where they confront the Cybermen actually sort of comes in to interrupt a scene where the two of them are talking sort of about Rory. So Amy's found the engagement ring.
Well, no, she found the engagement ring last episode. Doesn't he talk about nothing is ever forgotten, not completely?
Yeah.
And at the same time, River's going off to get the Centurions and you've got that shadowy figure. So it's all parallel leading up to Rory's introduction at dealing with the Cybermen.
And what's happening here is that Moffat is kind of laying out something, and it's hard to believe that there isn't a subtext about Doctor Who here. You know, if it's remembered, it can be brought back.
Especially with animation.
But you also have this sort of clever thing where there's a fake out here, because that thing about people turning from stories into reality, turning from memory into actual people, we think that that's done with once it's explained Rory. And what we don't know is that it's going to be the climax of the next episode as well. Mm. I think that stuff's beautiful. It's very Douglas Adamsy too. You know, sometimes people fall out of the world and little things get left behind. And all that talk about miracles and coincidences and stuff like that, I think is just classic Adams.
Yeah. And doesn't ever bother you, Amy, that your life doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But it's subtle because, it's subtle. It is Stephen giving you a conversation that is setting up next week and answers that are going to be delivered, even if at this point in time you kind of think, oh, yeah, he's just giving you a bit of mystery and maybe you don't think twice necessarily about it. But it's the joy of his writing.
I think what's super interesting is that we had the duck pond in episode one, which is a duck pond without ducks. It's empty. There should be ducks there. We think they're ought to be ducks there, but there are no ducks. There's no one in her house. She says she doesn't have a mum and dad, but we never hear what happened to them. We find out kind of what happened to them in the second episode of the two-part Angel story, when we discovered that people can be drawn into the crack and then forgotten by everyone else. So that's been there again, hiding in plain sight. And so the Doctor is starting to sort of edge towards that, and he's always been aware, once he's kind of seen the crack, that that's what's happened to Amy's mum and dad.
And Stephen introduces that in a really interesting way, because part of the writer's job is to segue between plot threads and, you know, push the narrative on. And Stephen does this very interesting thing where sometimes he will just have the character stop talking and one character will deliver the line which pushes them on to the next scene. And Matt does that in that scene. The Doctor does it, where they've been talking about something completely different and the Doctor just looks at Amy after a short gap and says, doesn't it ever worry you that your life doesn't make sense? And so he just puts it straight out there rather than being clever with the way that they transition to it.
I think that's the last line of that scene, isn't it, before the Cyberman appears? I think that that's where that ends.
I think you're right. Well, Rory ends the Cyberman. Like he says he's Amy, and then, of course, the Doctor comes in for another hilarious moment. Like, you know, how have you been? Yeah, good, good. And what? No, is that? No, sorry. He comes in and talks to Rory about missing the obvious and goes out. Do you like that? Do you think it's a little bit overdone?
Or is it calm?
It's slightly over-egged.
I think, though, the reason it works is Arthur Darvill's reactions.
He's great, isn't he, yeah, Brendan? Just his reactions to all of that. But then when the Doctor comes back and it's, oh, hello, how have you been? Good, Roman, you know, blah, blah.
But But, like, the absolute sitcom moment. Firstly, he calls him Rory twice before he notices that he's there.
Yeah.
And he talks about not being someone who misses the obvious. He goes out of shot and then drops something noisily. So there's a crash.
And doesn't Rory give sort of a little nod to him?
And then he comes back in. Then he pushes Rory with one finger.
That's wonderful.
And Rory goes back and then forward. And you can hear the leather of his armor creaking. It's so great. It's so funny. Maybe Murray overdoes it with his sort of little comedy music that comes in there.
But I love the fact after we've just had a lot of tension and a big dramatic moment, that Stephen just, you know, turns things 180 degrees and suddenly you've got a comedy moment which sort of breaks the tension and you're reintroducing the wonderful Arthur Darvill back into the cast.
And that's the thing about Stephen. People miss this about his writing. They think he's all about sort of big ideas and clever tricks. He's also just hilarious.
Yeah.
He writes really funny scenes.
Yeah, yeah. All the way through this, I was just sort of super aware of how funny everything is. I love, you know, very early on, even in the pre-credits teaser, where the Doctor goes, 1.02 a.m., no wait, 1.02 p.m., all right, 1.02 a.d. And, like, it's not just funny. It's clever. Like, would you have thought of it? And I just, you know, that experience of being wowed by how smart dialogue is something that I've been missing, I think.
Doctor Who is always funny when it does the Romans.
Yeah.
Even the Eaters of Light, but that wasn't funny, ha ha.
Oh, God. I like the Eaters.
Yeah, I do too, Tom.
I do not, but anyway.
What about the shot where Matt is on Stonehenge talking to all of the aliens in the sky and all of those spaceships and the way that is shot with the wind and what and how he's delivering it as well, Nathan?
It's so amazing. It's such an odd choice, the way that he does it. It's nothing that you would predict, I think.
Mm. I gather that it was Toby Haynes who said to Stephen Moffat, how about we do it like he is in the middle of Wembley? Yeah, he this isn't just the Doctor telling off the villains. This is the Doctor realizing that the villains are his captive audience. And just in performing it in that way, the Doctor is saying, no, 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 I'm in control. Even though you've got all your ships up there and all your guns, none of you have fired yet, and there's a reason for that. I'm in control, thank you. And he's not.
No, I mean, because there are sort of spotlights and stuff, which are sort of practical lights, presumably intending to be lights from the spaceships and stuff. And there's wind and kind of rain and stuff like that. So he's having to shout all over that. And he pauses while he's talking. There's two incredible moments, which is where he does the I am talking and they all stop and the camera pulls up. It's above and it pulls up into the sky and we see him getting smaller and smaller. And then the very end where he drops that loud kind of shouting over a Wembley crowd delivery and just says, let someone else be the first to try in his kind of normal sort of register. I think it's so good.
It's so visually striking as well. I mean, you can imagine in the 80s under a director like Ron Jones, a bunch of spaceships above Stonehenge while the Doctor talks would have looked execrable. Yeah. Whereas
Ron Jones, now we have Peter Moffat there as well. It's better and better.
The decision just to represent those spaceships by basically Close Encounter style lights,
yeah,
sort of moving above, absolutely makes the scene. And of course, Stephen's been looking to give Matt these wonderful speeches all season. He gave him one in the 11th hour, which obviously worked brilliantly. He gets one in the Angels. He's been searching as a child of the Hinchcliffe era and as the Ark in Space, his favorite story. He's been searching to give Matt really good, indomitable speeches. And here he just does it again.
Could you imagine David Tennant doing this one?
You know, I don't think David Tennant would have failed at this, but it would have been just vastly less interesting.
Let someone else try first. Apples and pears, apples and pears.
It is interesting that, like, Stephen comes back to that point, let someone else try first. Like, back in the library two-parter last season, like, I'm the Doctor, look me up, you know, and they sort of back off. And it's something that he now continues to use quite often where the villains, you know, I'm the Doctor, look me up. Or
is that the what does River say about him in Silence in the Library or Forest of the Dead, where he could turn whole armies away with a single word or something like that?
Well, that sort of relates to here. They do turn away and stop, but really they've got something else up their sleeve.
Yes, that's the other thing too. It's so beautifully delivered that we actually think he's triumphed, but it turns out they were playing him all along.
I love that line, everything that ever hated you is coming here tonight. Not Mary Whitehouse or Lala Ward, though.
Not even Dodo.
To be fair, we hated Dodo. The Doctor just tolerated her.
There's a heartrending bit at the end where he says, did she miss me? And the Doctor's just like,
Yeah, his reaction is amazing.
The
gutted look on Rory's face is just incredible.
And Karen comes in and does an incredible comedy performance as well. You know, like, she's all loose-limbed and stuff because she's kind of coming off the drugs or whatever, but she's got a very Adina Monsoon vibe. She comes in, is super dismissive, you know, like, is kind of horny for Romans visibly in front of Rory.
And she's got that very Amy dialogue where she says, thanks for the sortie, nice sortie. I don't think that's the first time Rory's ever heard that.
Yeah, you're right, Nathan. Like, she really is doing a great job there as the supporting player in that scene without you really thinking about what she's actually doing. It's actually really selling how distressed he is about the whole thing.
Yeah, that's right. She's completely kind of more or less unaware of him or absolutely dismissive of him in this sort of comedy way, which makes it worse for Rory, I think. Mm.
And then when we do move above ground and it moves totally away from comedy, it's heartbreaking in the writing, but Karen also plays it so well where she just starts crying and doesn't know why.
Yeah.
It really got to me when I was watching it.
Yeah, yeah. That whole plot is so affecting. And again, the genius of Stephen Moffat is you think it's going to go in a very maudlin direction of Rory, you know, pontificating about why Amy doesn't remember it, blah, blah, blah. And Stephen Moffat is just like, I'm not interested in that. No one's interested in that. The Doctor says, shut up and go talk to her. And Rory's like, but why am I here? What happened to me? And the Doctor's just like, I don't care. You're here. That's a wonderful thing. Shut up and accept it. And to get back to what you were saying earlier, Nathan, and to use one of your phrases, so when you were talking about how does this fit in with cyber continuity, to use one of your phrases, I don't care about that. And the 10-year-old at home doesn't care about that. The 10-year-old at home is going to go, there's Daleks and there's Cybermen and there's Autons and there's a Hoix. I loved them. Is there a stake? I loved the Hoix.
You know, there was also Spiridons. We just couldn't see
them. And Visions.
They asked for Fusions, but they refused.
Oh, dear. Help me. but that's the thing. Stephen Moffat kind of goes down the route of saying, I've explained well enough how this could possibly have happened. Now let's get back to the human story.
And that's it. I mean, he's telling Rory to shut up because he has seen that Amy loves Rory, and it was in question at the beginning of the season, but it's not in question now. And so he says, shut up, go up there and kind of, you know, get her, really. And that's kind of the subtext of that. He's super confident that Rory's able to win her back.
And part of the tragedy of that whole scene is that Amy is too confident as well. Amy, earlier in the season, talked Professor Bracewell in Victory of the Daleks around and sort of made him human again through the power of her emotion. And she tries the same thing with Rory, and she's confident that she'll succeed, and she doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I mean, we said earlier this season that the bit after Hungry Earth and cold blood, that that's where the relationship has gone horribly wrong, where her decision to flee has had terrible consequences. And, you know, she doesn't even remember Rory anymore. And so the natural arc is for that to be fixed. You know, we have to be waiting for the other shoe to drop at that point in the season. And so doing the thing, it's an absolute episode 12 thing, isn't it, where that looks like it's going to be resolved only to be snatched away.
Yeah. And it's also, this becomes a trope of Stephen Moffat to do something really personally horrendous to the characters in the finale or the penultimate episode. So, you know, here Rory shoots Amy.
Yeah, yeah.
And basically kills her. And, you know, we're going to get these throughout Moffat's tenure. And I don't quite know. It feels like I should want to switch off the television at that moment. But I don't. There is something about the writing and the performance that makes me go, okay, that's horrible, but I want to see where this goes next. And we have it right up until Bill gets turned into a Cyberman in World Enough in Time, that it's a sickening moment, but you're like, I need to know how this turns out.
I mean, she spends decades down there with the Master. Like, I think Moffat's playing a kind of knife-edge game that clearly doesn't work for a lot of people. And it's because he's writing in this storybook register where the characters perform plot functions and deliver funny lines, but you can't kind of interrogate how they would feel. And it's part of a problem with Doctor Who, right? Right from the point where Billy Piper gets hit in the face by an adherent of the repeated meme and knocked unconscious and locked in a room. You know, why would someone who is as realistic as her, TV realistic as her in Rose, ever travel with the Doctor again after that's happened to her? So no one really works as a real person in the Doctor Who world. Mm. But Moffat pushes that further than most people would like, I think. And we'll see that next year. I think he flubs it a few times.
He goes too far next year.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you say about that moment in End of the World, Nathan, because that was the actual scene where new Doctor Who became Doctor Who for me. It felt like, you know, the companion's just been clobbered and put in a room to die by lightning coming through the walls.
Yeah.
I think it's an artifact of Moffat having been raised on the Hinchcliffe era.
Yeah.
Because he saw how strong Sarah was companion and everything that was thrown at Sarah Jane. And he's kind of, he's that's in his subconscious, and that's what he does with companions.
And I think we said that Sarah Jane didn't work for us in ways for that reason. As a character, the performance is, you know, impeccable, and we love Sarah Jane to death. But, like, why is she still travelling with the Doctor?
She ceased to become a real person.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think Moffat wants these people to be real people. I think they're sitcom characters, and I think that it works on a kind of sitcom logic that, you know, there's the male lead and the female lead and all of that sort of thing. I'm not as upset as people might be by Rory shooting Amy, but that might just be because it's the first time he pulls this.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. I'm not upset about it, but I feel like I should be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's the thing. I'm not even that upset when we get to Bill.
I hated the Bill thing so much.
But I think that's possibly because of the way it's resolved.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas, Nathan, I know, for instance, for a fact that you were quite upset with Dark Water Death in Heaven.
Yes. Yeah. 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 But again, I think that's a really, really good two-parter. And I just remember feeling an absolute sense of dread all the way through Dark Water. And it is, I think, just because Danny's death is so terrible, you know, so awful. I think it's the worst death in Doctor Who, like the most upsetting death, I think, in Doctor Who. But it's kind of that Stephen Moffat is operating at a register where it's impossible to read those companions as people, you know, and it's a feature of the show, but Moffat sort of turns it up to 11, I think.
And is it interesting that Moffat's not interested in interrogating that, but Russell is? And so we have those scenes in Army of Ghosts where Jackie talks to Rose and tells her that she's becoming a storybook character, tells her you're not going to be a real person anymore. You're just going to be some woman walking through a market on an alien planet and you won't be you.
You'll be a space person.
Correct.
Speaking of space people, we do have the whole Rory shoots Amy intercut with River's dilemma.
Yeah.
And her whole discovery of Amy's house and her room and the figures and the books on the Romans and the Pandorica and all of that leading into the final few minutes. I'm just going back to what Brendan said, where he doesn't really feel like upset at Rory killing Amy. I'm sort of similar because it's intercut with the Doctor getting put in the Pandorica.
Yeah.
Rivers getting trapped in the TARDIS and all these things are happening. And so I feel like all of these things are going to be resolved. Like I don't,
yeah.
She's not going to remain dead.
Yeah.
The Doctor's not going to remain trapped in the Pandorica. All these questions are going to be answered. And I think they are in the next episode. So I guess jumping back to River for a bit, you know, and what she's discovering, it's interesting how he's writing her into the TARDIS, sort of putting her in the side plot. Perhaps I'm jumping ahead like the next week, but getting rid of her, but she's still discovering all these important plot points.
Yeah. Do you think the burn marks outside Amy's house are Daleks have landed?
Yeah.
Like, so that's
like in Remembrance of the Daleks.
Yeah. The Daleks have landed. They've gone upstairs to her bedroom. They've read all of her books. You know, they've gone through the photo collection.
Who is Nancy Drew?
A couple of them flew in through the skylight like they did with Adelaide.
It's so great that he gives them such a preposterous non-science fiction job.
Yeah.
You know, it could have been anyone else, but it's the Daleks who are rummaging through Amy's stuff, you know, in her bedroom.
Daleks do not understand choose your own adventures.
It's interesting you say that because I don't think the first time through it registered there were burn marks there, that they were even Daleks, that the house had been ransacked by whatever monsters.
Yeah, yeah.
A part of the Alliance. But it's interesting how, like, you've got the books on Roman, so that's come true, and you've got the Pandora's box, and that's in the Pandorica, but then you've got the picture of Rory. Now, if he's been erased from time, would it have ever existed, that picture? I'm a bit confused by that one point.
So did they go there before he got erased, or doesn't the Doctor say people fall out of the world but things get left behind?
Okay, so again, Stephen is actually explaining the cracks perhaps in his plot away through lines.
He's always one step ahead of us.
That's right. And it's something that I think only when you come back to rewatch his episodes is that you pick up on all of these things. And often in the moment, because there's so much wonderful dialogue and things going on, you miss, well, I do anyway, miss little bits and pieces. So I kind of think, oh, has he explained all of that? I'm a bit, you know what I'm like, where I want everything signed, sealed and delivered in a bow. And it actually is all there in plain sight when you go back and rewatch it.
Mm. Won't you be lucky next week for the series? The one of Amy's favourite childhood books was Doctor Who in an Exciting Adventure with the Daleks. Also, to what you said about everything is kind of answered, do we ever get an answer for why the TARDIS is blowing up, or is it just for space reasons?
It is. I think it is just for space reasons. There are throwaway comedy lines in Time of the Doctor where he kind of realises that he never explained it. And so there's something about, oh, I don't know, the silence or something. And it's surprising how little that matters. I think this two-part finale is triumphant. Central to it is the TARDIS exploding. And it looks like it's going to be the silence because we get a voice on the screen saying silence will fall, but Series 6 never really resolves it either.
No. I also think this cliffhanger is a product of having to follow on from Russell.
Yeah.
So, you know, Stephen knows that he's been handed an incredibly popular show, but he also knows from all of his experience in television that it would be very easy to fumble it and get it wrong, which is why he follows Russell's structure so much this season. But I think for this cliffhanger, he's looking back at Russell's last big season cliffhanger, which is The Stolen Earth. And so the cliffhanger for The Stolen Earth, you've got the Doctor is regenerating in the TARDIS. Sarah has almost run over some Daleks in her Nissan Figaro, and now she's going to get shot.
That'll never not be funny.
Gwen and Yanto are unloading submachine guns into a Dalek while screaming, you know, everyone is in some form of danger. So Moffat is like, I need to put everyone in some form of danger, but I don't have two spin-offs worth of characters to put in danger. So the Doctor's being locked in a box that we know takes several hours to open and can only open if it feels like it. And there's a bunch of monsters outside. River is in the TARDIS. She's locked in there and it's exploding and we don't know what is happening. And Amy is dead and Rory is an Auton. Oh, and by the way, every star in the universe is blowing up at every point in its history. Fade to black, cliffhanger scream, no next time trailer, titles.
Get out of that one, whoever writes the next episode.
It sounds like it's good. Oh my God, it's so good. It's so ambitious. And the special effect of all the stars exploding, the last thing we see is Earth and we fade to black and the music is interrupted by that. It's so well done.
And is the stars fading? Does that look like the Van Gogh painting?
Oh, yeah, a little bit. The stars are all kind of swirling and stuff like that.
I can't even say Metalla Orionsis.
It's incredible, isn't it?
I hope that Triton comes back in the reset. Right, but you are right. Like, you know, all of that going to black and just having the Earth, it's sort of a bit of a mirror of like when we come in.
Yeah.
The shots that always come into Earth at the beginning of Russell's and even this season with Stephen Moffat.
But yeah.
It's now it's sort of the pull back and it's just this little dot.
Very evocative shot, just Earth left by itself in a sea of blackness.
But I love the fact that there are all those different cliffhangers to resolve. And you're quite right, Brendan, you know, how can Stephen compete with what Russell's done before? And here you go, people, here are all my multiple cliffhangers and hopefully you'll like at least one of them to come back or more than one.
Yeah.
And can we make a mention for how beautifully it's shot? Toby Haynes is fantastic throughout the episode. But in particular, the cliffhanger and the build-up is so beautifully put together. All of those wonderful, slightly slow-motion scenes with River in the TARDIS, intercut with the Doctor being dragged into the Pandorica and Rory holding Amy. I mean, it's just superbly shot.
But isn't the inside of the Pandorica like a blue-green color? Like it's a slightly different lighting. And in some of the shots, Matt looks absolutely stunning, like the way in which he's actually framed. I think, yeah, you're totally right, Peter. The direction and the lighting in that is just utterly superb.
There's not a shot wrong in the entire episode. It's just masterfully done.
That's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week, if there is a next week, to try and work out what in God's name is going on in the Big Bang. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger and Jody into Terror. Until next time, please remember your training about Dr. Song's hallucinogenic lipstick. We only just kissed you 2 minutes ago, and already you imagine that we've been droning on about this silly TV show for more than 210 episodes. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Kiss, kiss.
See you soon.
Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley, Peter Griffiths and Brendan Jones. Theme arrangement by Cameron Ladd. This episode, Space Reasons, was recorded on the 9th of May 2020 and released on the 30th of May. Now that the universe has been destroyed, a post-credits joke seems somehow inappropriate. So instead, let me thank the many guests who joined us this series. Stephen from New to Who, Kevin Bernard, Col Salito, Simon Moore, Karen Carpenter, Johnny Spandrel, Eric Stadnick, Fiona Tomney, Jack Shanahan, and Joe Ford. We'll see you next week. I think that's it.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah,
it's good discussion.
Yeah, that was so good. There's so much to say. It's so good.
I will give you the link, but someone at a convention made Sylvester do the speech, and it's actually quite good. Like, it's actually madder because it's Sylv sight reading.
It's like he's drunk or something. You know, like there's something. You know, like he really is sort of selling the "I've got nothing left to lose" thing. And he's doing his sort of weird posh boy accent and stuff like that.
And he changes his delivery. So he slows things down and then speeds things up and delivers things in a staccato way sometimes.
Yeah. So good. I think later on they give him sort of things that we know Matt Smith can do in the scripts. And I always think that's a shame because what Matt Smith can do is something you've never seen before. And you know, I think they just sort of turned to sort of, you know, Matt Smithy things. You know, I felt the speech in Rings of Ackerton, which is supposed to be like this, absolutely falls flat and is sort of super embarrassing, really.
And again, Colin's done a version of that. In that case, it's actually much better.
Well, I can imagine.
Mainly because to hear Colin Baker performing as his doctor, and most of that speech is quite erudite, but then to hear Colin Baker saying, "You take it all, baby."
John Pertwee said that once.
That's not going in.
No. Well, I like the Rings of Agatha.
Yeah.
Colin was David Troughton's flatmate. Just saying.
All right. I'll stop recording.
Hang on. Do you want to do
the outro?
Oh, yeah. Maybe. Do we do the outro? I always forget that. We have an outro.
Do we want to talk about the title a bit as well? I really love the fact that it's a verb title.
Well, no. It's not a verb. It's a sentence. So,
yes,
it's not just a verb phrase. It's a full sentence. So, we have verb phrases like kill the moon and let's kill Hitler.
The doctor dances.
Well, that's its first one that's a sentence, I think. Isn't it?
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Don't shoot the pianist is obviously a sentence, but that's a single episode.
We should have had more of those in the classic series.
Yes, well,
kill Delta.
bring it on,
the
baby.
The Nymon pursues.
We did almost have "Is there a doctor in the horse?"
Yes, he did. Yes. That would have been great.
What's "All roads lead
to
Rome"?
Nightmare. Yeah, that's a sentence. Rome, and "The nightmare begins" is a sentence.
Yeah. Well, we did it more often than we think, don't we?
Well, no story titles, I don't think, but certainly episode titles.
Hmm.
Yeah. But I think the Doctor Dances are the first one that's a thing. Yeah, it was like when "Attached" was a Star Trek. Yeah. When "Attached" was a Star Trek title, and I thought, oh, adjective. Well, maybe it's a verb. Okay. All right, here goes. Well, dear listener, that's all we have time for this week.